You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Environmentalists are among those weighing in against attacking Iraq. But there's a problem. There's division within the Sierra Club as to just what the anti-war resolution should say. Dan Kent is with the Glen Canyon Club of the Sierra Club's Utah chapter, and Alan Madison is a spokesman with the National Office of the Sierra Club. They both spoke with Peace Watch today to flesh out the details of the debate.
Back in the middle of November, after a long discussion with our activists around the country who wanted to take a position urging for peace, the Sierra Club took a position calling for peaceful resolution to everything going on in Iraq. Let the UN inspectors do their job and disarm Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction, but do it in a peaceful way. Since then, we've been active in the group Win Without War, which is coalition of MoveOn.org, NAACP, National Organization of Women, a whole slew of groups as part of that coalition.
Dan, has the Glen Canyon Club taken a position, and how does your position differ from the national stance?
Well, actually, things are moving in the right direction now. It's been wonderful to see the Sierra Club become a part of Win Without War. Again, like Alan said, a broad coalition of groups. It's a wonderful thing, and I have no idea if we had any impact or if things were already moving in that direction, but we had been concerned about what we consider to be a gag order by the Sierra Club National Board and something that they did, which was pointing out in their resolution that they passed that Iraq was the problem in terms of, quote-unquote, the global dangers presented by possible Iraqi aggression. And that made us nervous to have the Sierra Club actually backing up George Bush's unfounded claims that Iraq was capable of global aggression. We're still hoping that they can back off of that position and rephrase their resolution so that at least that is not part of it.
What is the exact wording of the resolution, Alan?
It says the Sierra Club is concerned about the global dangers presented by possible Iraqi aggression and about the dire environmental consequences of war. The Sierra Club supports disarming Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. The Sierra Club commends the U.S. and other United Nations Security Council members for their unanimous resolution calling for the restoration of the disarmament inspections process as a means of achieving a peaceful resolution of the Iraq issue, and urges all nations to work through the UN to achieve this objective. The process of inspection should go forward immediately with and pursuant to international consensus, as expressed by the UN Security Council resolution. Even if the UN succeeds, however, this process will be incomplete if the U.S. and other nations fail to recognize that their continued dependence on oil and other fossil fuels is itself a significant destabilizing influence in international affairs. The Sierra Club, therefore, reaffirms its urgent call for the U.S. to move to a clean energy economy, greater efficiency, and use of renewable sources of energy.
So, Dan, is there still language in there that your chapter, your club, is offended by?
Well, a further part of the resolution actually says, the Board of Directors clarifies our standing 1981 IUCN resolution on peace as a broad general policy framework, which does not authorize individual members, leaders, or club entities to take public positions on military conflicts as they arise.
And then it says, only the Board or Conservation Governance Committee may adopt a formal public position on a future armed conflict or legislation related to it. No resolution may be used by any club entity or leader to praise or criticize any public officials for actions or statement which they took prior to its adoption by the Board of Directors.
So it sounds like you're basically saying that the national office maintains the sole right to establish the formal position for the organization?
That's right, Verna, because basically, on every issue, we're going to have people who think that whenever we take a position, some people are going to think our position was too strong on an issue, some people will think the position was too weak, and some people are going to think we shouldn't have taken a position at all. And that's whether the issue is logging in national forests or protecting Utah's Red Rock deserts
or the immigration policies.
Immigration
that happened
policy
10 years
or
ago.
Iraq, exactly. So you're always going to have a broad group of answers, and what the Sierra Club seeks to do is nationally is come to a consensus. We've got 700,000 members around the country, and not everyone's going to agree. So
well,
what this is saying is, let the National Board of Directors, who are directly elected every year by the members, let them come to a consensus of what the members want.
How did you arrive at the position? Was a poll taken? What is the process, and how does it ensure fairness of representation of the membership?
Over a couple of months, over about 6 weeks or so, leading up as it looked like Bush was having this big drumbeat to war and people were getting concerned about it, the Sierra Club Board of Directors, this directly elected by the members, surveyed a whole slew of different committees within the Sierra Club and chapters and asked chapters to weigh in and say, hey, what is it that you want the Council of Club Leaders, which is a body that incorporates chairs from every chapter around the country and the Sierra Student Coalition and Sierra Club of Canada and all these different organizations, that body weighed in.
A pretty broad base.
Oh, a very broad base. The Conservation Governance Committee, which is another group of Sierra Club leaders, they weighed in. And as I said, chapters from around the country weighed in. So, you know, you've got everyone from people in Utah weighing in, people in Nebraska weighing in.
And so they weighed in, and then what?
And then the board of directors, these 15 leaders from around the country, volunteer activists, debated it. And they hammered out what they could come to as the best consensus for what the club as a whole wanted, which was, the key of it was, peaceful resolution to the Iraq conflict and, more importantly, for our long-term security and for the world's long-term benefit, breaking the U.S.'s dependence on oil.
The picture that Alan paints is a nice one, and I wish that that's the way that it was. But the fact is the discussion on the CCL list, the Council of Club Leaders, was very powerfully in favor of condemning war in general, more unequivocally, any war against Iraq. And what the board unfortunately came up with out of this was a resolution that they have used now to stop people from commending our representatives in Congress that have opposed the war, including Nancy Pelosi, the new leader of the Democratic Party in the House. It's kind of in stark contrast to where the club has come before with this. Most resolutions, in fact, every resolution that we've been able to find that we've looked at involving this, has been used to clarify club positions so that people could take a stand on issues. This is the first one that I've ever seen that clarifies it, it's actually rather obscure to me because it's strangely worded, and that's one of our problems too, but it doesn't clarify anything. It says that you can't speak out on these things. And the 1981 resolution that it supposedly is clarifying may have been a broad public policy, but it very strongly came out against nuclear weapons. And it's the kind of thing that you would expect that we would be using to condemn Bush's talk of using tactical weapons, nuclear weapons, if, you know, as one of the possible outcomes if Saddam were to attack us.
Now, Dan, I heard language in the resolution that Alan read that said something to the effect of disarming Iraq, and it seems to make the presumption that Iraq does have arms or weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
Is that sort of a bone of contention within your club or not?
Well, I don't think that anybody would mind seeing Saddam just disappear from the face of the planet. But the problem here is that the Sierra Club, just by talking about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and the global dangers presented by them and by Iraqi aggression, kind of plays into the idea that they have, you know, that they are the problem now and we need to be going after them at a time when our freedoms are rapidly disappearing. Osama bin Laden is nowhere to be seen. 3,000 civilians lie dead in Afghanistan. This is playing into the hands of pursuit of perpetual warfare in the Middle East is what we see. And we would like to be free to oppose that, as many resolutions in the past have directed us towards doing. Most of them passed in the 1981 era when nuclear warfare was a real possibility. And we see that raising its ugly head once again for the first time in a generation.
Why, Dan, is an environmental group so concerned about a war in Iraq? Considering the controversy around this issue amongst environmentalists, isn't it perhaps better left for the political groups?
You know, I wish, actually, privately, I wish that nothing had ever been said about this, because it didn't clarify anything, and the resolutions were already in place that were needed. I think you're probably right that this is that as an environmental group, we probably shouldn't be getting involved in international conflicts, although right now, you know, as shown by the groups that are going to demonstrate on the 18th of January in D.C. and San Francisco and other places, there's over 800 groups now that are allied to do something about this, to speak out. It's an opportunity to stop a war before it starts, and there's very few things more urgent than the potential of global warfare. Not only that, but the last Iraqi war was incredibly environmentally destructive. All wars is incredibly environmentally destructive. So I think it's incumbent upon us to do something about this. Not only that, but the short-term impacts of preparing for war hit us in Utah really hard. You know, there's waste being transported to Yucca Mountain. We have a lot of downwinders that live in this place from past atomic bomb testing. And now just south of where I live on White Mesa in Utah's Red Rock Canyon country, they're developing a de facto waste storage facility that is receiving wastes from the Manhattan Project. I mean, this stuff doesn't go away. And we've got to acknowledge that preparing for war is a major environmental issue.
Now, is there any disagreement amongst environmentalists on that issue, Alan?
Not that I can fathom, no. I mean, I think that, you know, what Dan talks about is exactly right. When you think about back as Hussein was retreating in 1991 and all of the burning of the oil fields and the havoc that wreaked, and it all gets back to one thing, all gets back to oil. And that's exactly this undue influence that the Saudi Arabias and Iraqs and Irans of the world have because of our dependence on oil. If we can get folks here in the U.S. to stop guzzling gas, if we can finally get Congress to stop standing in the way of better fuel economy so that we're not pumping money into the Saudi Arabian government every time we show up at a gas station, so we're not pumping money into Saddam Hussein's government by pumping up at the gas station, by having better cars that go farther on a gallon of gas, we can start breaking this dependence.
Alan Madison of the National Office of the Sierra Club and Dan Kent with the Sierra Club's Utah chapter. Congress recently passed the largest reorganization of the federal government since the end of World War II, merging 22 agencies, 170,000 employees, the CIA, the FBI, all into the new Department of Homeland Security. Today, the Office of Personnel Management held a press conference to brief the prospective employees of the new Homeland Security Agency. Peace Watch wonders how this new entity might address the longstanding problems in the intelligence agencies, including those that permitted the 9/11 attacks. We also want to know how the Homeland Security Act might impact the war on terrorism and the impending war in Iraq. We spoke to Frontline producer Michael Kirk about his research for The Man Who Knew and Gunning for Saddam.
Like any piece of legislation, it depends on the implementation and on the political will and on the actual procedural and structural, composition of what ends up being the Homeland Security Department. The notion that intelligence will somehow be centralized, perhaps shared by people who are expert, protected so that civil liberties are protected, et cetera, well-discussed and worried about questions. All in terms of all of those matters, there's nothing from what I learned in the making of The Man Who Knew that would lead me to believe that much about the new Homeland Security Act augurs well for the protection of the American people from, to the extent that they exist, outside terrorist threats.
How extensive was your research, and what would you say was the most startling fact that you uncovered?
Well, we worked on the film, a group of us, investigative reporters and me as a producer and a director and a writer, for about a year. Not entirely exclusively, but since September 11th, 2001, and settled in on John O'Neill, who was the chief of counterterrorism for the FBI in Washington for a while, and then out of the New York office, settled on him as the man who knew, as the sort of central character of the narrative, sometime in December or January. But we were, before then, working very hard to find out what was up with the FBI and the CIA and who had known what and when and what they'd done with it. So for about a year, we worked on the subject, and our stunning, I think, to us, revelations, and to the audience that saw it, at least the literally thousands of people who sent emails, was that there were individuals inside the United States government, even inside the much maligned, and for good reason, FBI, who actually knew of the pending threat and were not listened to for a variety of deeply structural reasons, as well as profoundly and, I think, shockingly personal reasons. The idea that office politics played out, you know, as it is everywhere, could be played out around such an important topic was surprising to me.
So do you think that those structural reasons and those structural and personal and office politics reasons continue to plague the system and the process to the point where if there were another impending attack against the U.S., that it might be somehow camouflaged or the handwriting on the wall would be ignored once again?
People I know, sources of ours who are still inside the FBI and the Central Intelligence Agency, people who were there and witnessed the events that surrounded John O'Neill, the events that surrounded the East Africa bombings and the bombing of the coal in Yemen, say to us virtually nothing has really changed in the year, that the kind of problems we talked about and the kind of problems that we've all heard about, or at least some of us who've paid attention have heard about, are not unique to just John O'Neill, but are still there, are important and deep-seated problems that are not going to go away with the passing of a piece of legislation. They are about the orientation of those institutions to people who think outside of the box. They are about a depoliticizing an environment like the intelligence agencies to the extent that that's possible, and upgrading it, yet doing so in the face of legitimate civil liberties concerns. There are a number of those kind of problems that people who are still in the agencies and the Bureau and people who contacted us after the program aired who work inside those places have warned us are still huge problems. There are, for example, people inside the FBI right now who are in positions that they say to know, who firmly believe there are no al-Qaeda cells in the United States, that al-Qaeda has been seriously destroyed and broken up and never really was a major a terrorist organization, and got kind of lucky, if that's the right word, on September 11th, but that the politics of the moment are such that they could never say this out loud. The FBI could never make that argument out loud because of the rush to war and the rush to war and the imperative to fight a war on terrorism. One needs an enemy in order to do that. So there's much contradictory information inside the Bureau. Is it being evaluated, argued about, brought forward to the American people? And under what circumstances are those arguments taking place? And the answer is, I fear, not as vigorously as it probably should be.
Well, as we sit here in this climate of the rush to war, knowing what you know about the research, knowing what you know about the possibility of an pending attacks on the U.S., given the research that you've done, what are your thoughts about the U.S. planning to invest, you know, billions, perhaps trillions of dollars in a war against Iraq in the name of fighting the war against terrorism and helping Americans feel safe and secure against a threat from Saddam Hussein?
I made a film a year ago, a little over a year ago, called Gunning for Saddam, which was about the notion of what the argument was from the Defense Policy Review Board to Paul Wolfowitz and Secretary Rumsfeld, and of course to the President of the United States, George Bush, about why Iraq should be next, or even why Iraq should have been first before Afghanistan. You know, an argument made by Richard Perle and other forces. We kind of examined and took apart, held up to the light much of the arguments that have finally, I guess, rested firmly inside the President's and the Defense Department's planning and logic to aim for Iraq. And interestingly, it all kind of neatly converged with what we were learning about the FBI and what they knew and when they knew it, and the inherent problems in intelligence gathering and evaluation, and what to paint a bullseye on, And it is complicated, very complicated business. The question we raised with Gunning for Saddam, and the question that's inherent in the O'Neill film, is who is actually deciding, and on what basis are they deciding something is or is not a threat? And questions that I think we all need to ask about those institutions, which, are built and born out of a kind of secrecy and a groupthink, which isn't always all about openness and aggressive
transparency. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand you're working on another film that will be coming out shortly, and this film sort of deals with the newer strategies and approaches that would-be terrorists could be using to plan and plot attacks against the
U.S. We're in those sort of stages where we're trying to come to grips now with the potential for threat from cyber terrorists, for lack of a more precise term.
So it was airplanes last time. It'll be computers this time.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the there are like many things in a multifaceted democratic society. There are many opinions about how profound this threat is and where it comes from. There seems to be a very strong agreement that state-sponsored cyber war is very much a part of our future.
How might that look?
Well, it may be as basic as a nation attacking through the internet. I mean, it may be as fantastic as attacking the power grid in a major American a city or region. No, it may be as simple as flooding millions of emails and viruses and crippling some place, the White House, for example. Mm-hmm. There have been assaults like that. There's very much a kind of holding your breath moment about the idea that if we go to war with Iraq in that early going, there will be web assaults perpetrated on America from foreign shores.
Michael Kirk, producer for Frontline. Syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington, meanwhile, spoke out recently about how the bill that created this new department was laden with special favors to politically influential corporations, as well as the Bush administration's manic attempt against all evidence to link Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda, syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington.
The reason why this is an extraordinary moment and a dangerous moment is because we have an administration that has reached a level of chutzpah, that's a good Greek word, that is quite unprecedented. And before I move on to my main reasons against the war on Iraq, I want to say two things, two of the latest examples of this chutzpah that have been particularly troubling and disturbing. And they involve the Homeland Security Bill. In the Homeland Security Bill, in the 11th hour, there were two provisions put in. One was to protect Eli Lilly, the huge pharmaceutical company that has given $1.6 million in the last election cycle to the Republicans. And that provision, which nobody is claiming authorship for, is protecting Eli Lilly to the tune of billions of dollars in terms of legal liability from parents of autistic children who are considering that there is a link between tyramycin, an additive in certain vaccines that Eli Lilly has manufactured, and the autism of their children. And it is extraordinary in a democracy that such a provision, which is completely and utterly unrelated to Homeland Security, is put in because this is the bidding of the corporate donors that are dominating Washington. And adding insult to injury, the Justice Department is trying to seal all the public documents that have been generated through all the court cases that parents have started so that we don't even know what the facts are and what the truth is. Now, there are people that when the 108th Congress starts in January are going to try and repeal it, people like Dennis Kucinich and people like John McCain and people like Debbie Stabenow. It's always the same people, right? But that's not enough. It's not enough to repeal it. It's enough to ask the fundamental question, what's happened to our democracy when things like that can happen and many, many times go undetected? And the other thing going on with this Homeland Security bill is that it's making it possible, contrary to what had been agreed before, that companies that are basically tax cheats, that go out into tax havens, start a P.O. box, and save billions of dollars in taxes, will still be able to get government contracts that have to do with the war on terrorism. Now, can you believe that? Not only are they costing the American taxpayer $70 billion a year, not only are they not participating in the cost of the war on terrorism, but now they're also going to be able to get government contracts, taxpayer-funded work, despite the fact that they have actually betrayed this country by going out to tax havens. How can this be justified? And why aren't the Democratic leaders up in arms about it? These are major populist issues. They're easy to explain. You can talk to anybody. They can be Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, whatever, and they see the injustice of that. And yet, nobody with a big enough megaphone is talking about them up and down the country.
Syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington speaking in Los Angeles at a conference titled The Price of War with Iraq. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer tonight was Sidrak Franklin. We had production assistance from Adhil Hamad of KPFA and Bente Brooklyn. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.